I'm Mark Summer, and this is a world of possibilities. This program, Fished Out, Draining the Seas of Their Bounty, is underwritten by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. Coming up in this half hour, we'll explore strategies to reverse the decline of the world's marine life. First, we turn to Jane Lubchenco, one of the world's leading marine ecologists. A professor of marine biology at Oregon State University, Jane is the former president of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science and the recipient of numerous awards for her work. One of the most frequently cited scientists in the world, she's received a MacArthur Genius Grant. She's a passionate advocate for the marine life that is the focus of her work. Jane Lubchenco joins us by phone from her office at Oregon State University in Corvallis. What are the obstacles to rapidly building a much broader system of marine reserves? As I understand it, about 1% of the world's ocean surface is marine reserves now, whereas about 11 or 12% of the land worldwide is set aside in some form of reserve.
The amount of reserves that do exist globally is, in fact, minuscule. It's even less than 1%. That said, there is increasing interest in the part of many in sort of at least learning about and exploring the possibility, what does this new tool have to offer us? When you set up a marine reserve, you get just a profusion of life inside it. There is very strong scientific evidence that things happen inside reserves that are very important to preserve habitat, to preserve biodiversity. There's also increasing evidence that there is export of young from those big fat individuals that are growing inside and protected by the reserve. And this is where there is tremendous potential for recovering depleted fisheries, at least for some species. And the secret of this is that when fish or invertebrates get a little bit bigger in size, that means a significantly greater increase in their reproductive potential. If you have, for example, a 14-inch rockfish, let's take a vermilion rockfish, one that's common off the west coast of the U.S. as an example. A 14-inch rockfish, on average, produces about 150,000 young. If you let that fish grow to 24 inches, that female vermilion rockfish would produce 1.7 million young. So if you can protect individuals inside a reserve by eliminating fishing, that can bring tremendous benefit outside the reserve as those young are transported by ocean currents.
So it ends up being like almost like a nursery for...
It's a natural hatchery. It's a nursery and a natural hatchery. And it seemed to many as though there was a potential conflict between use of marine reserves for conservation versus fishery benefit for the following reason. If you want conservation benefit, if you want to protect habitat and biodiversity, you might want to design huge, huge marine reserves because you want to capture most of those young that are being produced inside the reserve, not have them fall outside the reserve or be transported too far away from the reserve. So if for conservation benefit, you want to minimize export by having the largest possible reserve. On the other hand, if you want to have fishery benefit, you want to maximize export. You want those young to get out so that you can have them recharge depleted fisheries and eventually be caught. That seemed like a built-in conflict. That's now been resolved with the use not of single reserves, but of networks of reserves that give you both a large total amount of area and also a lot of export, a lot of leaky edges. So if you have a network of reserves that are the right distances from one another, you can, in fact, have your cake and eat it too, or have your fish and eat them too. You can have both conservation benefit as well as significant fishery benefit.
So does it amount to something like a patchwork pattern? Instead of having one vast reserve, you have numerous ones that are nearby one another and the fish migrate among them?
That's correct. So a network is simply a series of reserves that are connected by the movement of juveniles, adults, or young. There are a number of newly established reserves, but the idea is counterintuitive to many, and there is great resistance around the world to using marine reserves or networks of marine reserves for the very simple reason that it's counterintuitive to fishermen in particular that they're going to gain something if they give something up. To have areas that have traditionally been open to fishing all of a sudden off limits is not a very appealing idea. In places around the world where reserves have been established, in most cases, fishermen who were very strongly against the reserve, once it was implemented and they began to see significant benefit to them, are very much to their credit saying, hey, I was wrong about this. It's actually something that, to my surprise, is turning out to be a good thing.
You've been studying the marine environments since the 1970s. Do you feel that, on the whole, marine biology has advanced in its understanding of the complexity of these ecosystems and that that is helping us understand how to preserve and rebuild them?
There's no doubt that we have vastly greater information about marine ecosystems than we did a couple of decades ago. That said, there's a huge amount that we don't know. There are so many new discoveries to be made. There, I think, is increased realization on the part of many marine scientists that there's urgency in getting some kinds of answers quickly because the systems are changing so very rapidly. There's a real spirit now within the marine scientific community, more of a passion to be helping identify the problems and potential solutions so that society can be making smarter decisions. When I was on the Pew Oceans Commission, we went around the country and talked to lots of different people about what do they see happening in their backyards, what do they think the problems are in oceans, what are the solutions, and what do they want from oceans. And what I heard boiled down to, we would like healthy beaches, healthy seafood, abundant wildlife, vibrant coastal communities, and stable fisheries. To have all of those things, we really need productive, resilient, healthy marine ecosystems. And so I think we've moved now from thinking about exploitation of systems to how can we use them sustainably? And that's a very exciting and very daunting challenge. I'm cautiously optimistic that we will be able to make the kinds of changes that are needed. And that's partly tempered by the increasing awareness of the problem and the potential for some of these new tools, such as networks of marine reserves. We're going to do it, but it's going to be a tough challenge, and I'm willing to do my part.
Marine biologist Jane Lubchenco. After a short break, we'll hear about how each of us can save our salmon and bring back the cod.
What's that I smell, baby? There's fish scent all around. Yes, what's that I smell, baby? That fish scent is all around. Every time I come in, baby, fish scent all around.
This is A World of Possibilities, a production of the Mainstream Media Project. Copies of this program are available on CD and can be requested by email at comments@aworldofpossibilities.com.
Yes, I come home this morning, cigar butts all on the floor. Well, I know I hadn't been home all night long. It must have been the man next door.
After hearing such ominous news about the future of seafood, what can we do as individuals to help reverse these trends?
All right, then.
Fortunately, in this case, a lot. As conscientious consumers, we want to make food choices that promote sustainability. But standing at the fish counter or browsing through a restaurant menu, the options are tantalizing, and the factors to keep in mind almost overwhelming. To help us through the maze of considerations, the Monterey Bay Aquarium has developed a great tool, the Seafood Watch Guides. You can visit their website at mbayaq.org and print out a wallet-sized seafood guide for every region of the country. The guides list seafood in three categories. In the green category are the best choices. In the yellow category, there are good alternatives that are still subject to some concerns. Seafood in the red list should be avoided entirely. But even with these handy guides, it's still a challenge. So George Leonard, a senior science manager at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, is going to help us figure out what to order the next time we're asked by a waiter or butcher. George joins us from his office in Monterey, California. Let's look at the wild caught fish and which ones one finds most surprisingly in the avoid category. I think the one that I end up, well, no, it's actually you can still eat, no, you can't eat salmon can you eat salmon that's wild caught?
Yes, you can. Salmon, of course, is one of the most controversial species that's out there. It's also one of the most complicated. And I think it's also one that many consumers are really interested in, not only for the sort of inherent interest of salmon as a species in the wild, but because salmon just tastes so darn good and because it's really healthy for you. So if you look at our card, you're going to find salmon in really all three of our categories. Wild salmon, particularly wild salmon that's caught from Alaska, which has been certified by the Marine Stewardship Council as a sustainable series of fisheries up there, is in our best choice category. The fish are quite abundant, well-managed, and the habitat impacts of fishing are quite low. In contrast, the wild-caught salmon from the west coast of the U.S., that's really from California, Oregon, and Washington, is in this yellow category, which is are good alternatives or some concerns kind of category. And then in the red list, there's really no wild salmon that's in the red list. What's in the red list for us is farm salmon, and this is mostly Atlantic salmon that's farmed in a variety of countries around the world. The issues for farm salmon are quite different than they are from wild salmon, but they're strong enough that they end up in our red list.
Tuna, which people now know as both your son or daughter's lunch food, but also increasingly as the top-end fish in a restaurant, it seems that depending on the variety, it ranges from best choices to avoid.
Well, that's right. I mean, a tuna is another good example of a fish that people refer to as tuna, like motor oil is motor oil, you know, tuna is tuna. And in fact, tuna is extremely diverse. There's a number of different species. Many of those species, almost all of them, have a worldwide distribution, so you'll find them in all the oceans of the world. Many of them are caught with a whole diversity of different catch methods, so there are different bycatch concerns and different catch methods. And, you know, they'll end up everywhere from in the can to sashimi-grade tuna at your sushi bar. Now, the sort of poster child for an unsustainable fishery, and in this case, an unsustainable tuna fishery, is really bluefin tuna, and this is particularly bluefin tuna from the Atlantic. Now, that's not the case for other tunas. Tunas like big eye, tuna like yellowfin and albacore are in much better shape from a stock status perspective. And those fish that are, particularly when they're caught with troll pole methods, which are more traditional ways of fishing for tuna, you're going to find those in our best choices list.
I see that from a report in World Watch, as much as half of all of what is taken in the process of fishing ends up being discarded. That sounds like an enormously inefficient and destructive process.
That's because it is. In many respects, I think that the issue of bycatch is probably the number one kind of conservation concern relative to fisheries now and likely to be in the future. For a long time, people really worried about the status of the fish that they were fishing for and didn't really give too much concern to the bycatch that results while they're trying to capture that targeted fish. But it's become really clear that bycatch is a major problem, and part of that is because bycatch rates in certain kinds of fishing gear can be just astronomically high. For example, many trawl fisheries, that is nets that are dragged along the bottom and sort of indiscriminately catch whatever is in their path, their bycatch to landing ratios are generally near the 1-to-1 ratio, which means that for every unit of fish you catch and take home, you're throwing back a whole other unit, which is just extraordinarily wasteful, as well as having really unknown impacts on the marine ecosystem itself.
Does there need to be essentially a set of limits on both the size of the vessels that are doing the fishing and perhaps the methods that are being used?
The real key here, I think, with fishing is if you want to protect fish stocks, you just need to kill less fish. It sounds like a very simple thing to do, but it's actually quite difficult in when you have a fishery that consists of a number of boats and there's, say, in some fisheries, there are simply no what are called tacks, that is total allowable catch. So when you have that kind of fishery, it becomes very difficult to control the number of fish that are caught. Then if you have a tack, the question is, how do you regulate that in real time so that you can ensure that individual boats don't catch more than their fair share so that you don't go over that tack? As you can imagine, this gets really complicated and really convoluted. And this has led many folks to believe that marine reserves, essentially marine parks in the ocean, are a really good additional tool to protect ocean biodiversity. These are not a substitute for good, strong fishery management, but they could play a major role in essentially providing safe haven where fish would simply not be subjected to fishing pressure in those areas.
It seems to be, as in with so many resources, a have and have not dynamic at work here. The largest share of seafood is eaten on the coasts of developing nations, but because the population is so much larger, it's actually a far smaller amount per capita, and people in those nations are much more dependent on that source of food than are people who are eating it almost as a luxury in the West. So how do you deal with those inequities? If you're overfishing worldwide, you're taking it away in some way from people who absolutely depend on it.
Well, that's the $69,000 question. Much of aquaculture, and farmed salmon is a good example of this, but this is where a lot of the aquaculture growth is happening in what we refer to as kind of high-level carnivorous species, that is, fish that are dependent on wild-caught fish for their food, as opposed to herbivorous or omnivorous fish, things like tilapia and catfish, that feed more on a grain-based diet and, as a consequence, have very little reliance on ocean ecosystems for their food inputs. So what happens is that many of these low-level fish that might be able to be consumed in developing countries, things like sardines, anchovies, pilchards, mackerel, are being caught in vast concentrations and are being turned into fish meal and fish oil for a rapidly growing aquaculture market that is basically supplying high-value fish not to the developing world, but to the developed world itself. And I think it's increasingly driving the inequity that you describe.
I see that the Monterey Bay Aquarium has a Cooking for Solutions program and that it's getting chefs from restaurants to become involved.
Chefs play an incredibly important role in helping sort of set the agenda and get the word out about sustainability. If you think about both the positive and negative aspects of the power of the chef, you have to look to, say, Julia Child, who started talking about the delectable flavor of monkfish, a fish caught on the East Coast, 20 years ago or so, and started working with that product and talking to consumers about it. And the next thing you know, the demand for monkfish went through the roof, and as a consequence, it became overfished. The same thing is true for Chilean sea bass. It had its name changed from Patagonian toothfish to Chilean sea bass, and chefs started realizing how versatile a product it was, and the next thing you know, demand was too high on that fish. Well, what's happened now is that there's a whole group of chefs and restaurants that are much more attuned to the sustainability messages, and as a consequence, they can take that power, and rather than driving consumer pressure to fish that are poorly managed and that aren't really capable of withstanding added demand, they can turn their power to these fish that are in our green list.
Given all that you've said, it begins to seem like it's not that we can't eat more fish, which after all is a very healthy source of protein as well as a great pleasure to eat, but we need perhaps to become more creative. Many fish that have a milder flavor could be flavored with all kinds of sauces in very creative ways.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, we are certainly not telling people to eat less fish. In fact, You know, and that's our end goal here, is to not necessarily consume less, but to consume more. And the only way to consume more is to strengthen the fishery management regulations that are out there. So the real question is, what are your options? We need to remember that fish is not just fish. There's a huge diversity under that category. And that there's actually a huge diversity of fish that are quite sustainable in, for example, in our green list, our best choices. And that includes everything from many of the filter feeding mollusks like clams and mussels and oysters through the omnivorous farmed fish like catfish and tilapia, as well as many of the very stringently regulated wild fisheries like pollock and salmon that are wild caught from Alaska that have been certified by the Marine Stewardship Council. And the list continues on and on. So I think consumers need to know that there really are a large range of really good choices out there, and that folks that are willing to give those choices a culinary try and work with them in terms of developing recipes and as you say, give them a good sauce, there's a lot of great seafood still out there. But at the same time, we can't forget that there is a red list. There is this avoid list, and there are a range of species that are in really tough shape and have been for quite some time now. And we need to take the pressure off of those fish if we really hope to get them back onto our menus in a major way in the future.
George Leonard, Senior Science Manager at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Those of us who produce this program enjoy the good fortune of living along the rare, still half-wild coastline of Northern California, near a harbor where battered fishing boats haven't yet been replaced by luxury yachts. In the night, I wakened to see a jeweled necklace of bobbing lights offshore, where the crabbers tend their pots so we seafood lovers can pick the sweet, delicate crab meat from the shells. But even here, the catch is getting thin. While it's been a good year for Dungeness crab, there's no longer a local salmon season for commercial fishermen. Many are being forced to sell their boats, and they will not be replaced by others anytime soon. The price of salmon jumped 50% this year, and most of it shipped in from Alaska, frozen. Frankly, it's no match for the flavor and texture of freshly caught fish. Even here, it's the end of an era. When the salmon that are the totem species of this region are no longer plentiful, like the buffalo exterminated from the Great Plains more than a century ago, it's a harbinger of deeper loss, a potential collapse of both a fragile marine ecology and an equally fragile human civilization. But as the fishermen and marine ecologists make clear, we needn't go this route. Having watched the extermination of the buffalo and its accompanying loss of soul and sustenance, we can change course, make more intelligent seafood choices, save the salmon, and bring back the cod. By restraining our appetites for certain endangered species in the near term, we can assure a thriving fishery into the far future. Granted, on my palate, catfish doesn't quite measure up to Pacific salmon. But hey, if you can make tofu tasty, you can fry catfish into a savory delight. Spices, anyone? I'm Mark Sommer, and this has been A World of Possibilities. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to A World of Possibilities. For more information on today's topic, please click on the listener action link at aworldofpossibilities.com. This program was produced and edited by Chuck Rogers, Tim Silva, Brittany Danish, and Susan Seminoff. Production engineer is Chuck Johnson. Support for this program is provided by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. Music is courtesy of Digital Music Works International, Alligator Records, Putumayo World Music, Sony Music Entertainment, Capitol Records, and Elektra. Commercial sound clips courtesy of Red Lobster. This program is distributed by the WFMT Radio Network. Thank you for listening.